A dollar and a half just to see 'em. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jared Diamond, a professor of geography at UCLA and the recipient of many awards, including the National Medal of Science, the Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement, Japan's Cosmos Prize, a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, and the Lewis Thomas Prize honoring the scientist as poet. His books include Why is Sex Fun?, The Third Chimpanzee, Collapse, and Guns, Germs, and Steel, which won the Pulitzer Prize. And his latest book is The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Diamond.
Thank you, and it's nice to be back with you.
And your latest book, The World Until Yesterday, is in many ways it's a compendium of a lot of your experiences over the decades in New Guinea. And because I was born in Australia and spent some time in New Guinea, so I'm somewhat familiar with the notion that we can learn so much from these societies. One of the things that's most compelling in the book is a photograph that you have of a New Guinea Highlander weeping in terror at his first sight of a European. This happened in 1933, and you have an actual picture of the European confronting these New Guinea Highlanders. And I must say, when I look at this picture of this man in tears, you get the feeling that he really did know something, didn't he?
Well, he was certainly terrified. He identified Europeans as possibly returning ancestral spirits. But I must say, in my own experience in New Guinea, well, I've never had an adult burst into tears at the sight of me. In remote villages in New Guinea, there have been cases where a child who had evidently never seen a European before, the child turned around and looks at me, and within a few seconds, a look of horror appears on the face of the child, and the child bursts into tears.
So is it inexorable then that civilization destroys a planet? I mean, that's what I get from your book is the idea that the march of civilization, what it's done to us as human beings, our hunter-gatherer bodies, and what it's doing to our biosphere, it just seems inexorable that we're on a march towards some kind of collective extinction.
It's easy to get overwhelmed and pessimistic, as you formulated, but in fact, there are signs of both hope as well as pessimism. There are societies that have managed their resources well. There are traditional societies, the subject of my current book, that have remained intact in contact with the outside world, even though they've changed selectively. A prime example is Japan, which, when opened up forcibly by the outside world, by America and then Europeans in the 19th century, made some significant changes, but Japan is still Japanese. And even within the territory of the United States, Navajo Indians, who are now the most numerous Native American group in North America, the Navajo, half of them still speak Navajo, and they've retained a lot of their traditional culture. So it's not the case that everything is bad and that everybody crumbles.
Well, based on your book Collapse, Jared Diamond, of course, just 2 weeks ago, the world was supposed to end according to the Mayan calendar. So at least we're still speaking to each other, although, of course, the Mayans did collapse. So there is, you know, clearly there is a history of extinction, and there have been mass extinctions. And one of the challenges to the biosphere now, of course, is how we deal with global warming. But when you look at population growth, and some biologists tell us that the ideal population of the planet is about 1 billion in terms of the biosphere, it's only relatively recently that population has exponentially expanded, and that the world that you talk about in your new book, The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies, they have been living for thousands of years prior to this population explosion. So I understand that resource depletion and energy use and population growth are the main factors determining the livability of our planet. How do we get back to the natural world? You're suggesting that perhaps that we can adapt to how much we've already changed the world.
It's a mixture of things. We can adapt and stop making further damage. We can adapt and repair some of the damage that we've already caused. We can't bring back species that have gone extinct, but we can bring back populations of species that have not yet gone extinct. And then there's a lot that we can learn from the traditional world to improve our own lives. From my 50 years of experience in New Guinea, I'm impressed by how New Guineans deal with danger and how they raise their children and how they treat their older people, and I've incorporated a lot of that into my daily life, my attitude about dangers, for example, about the dangers of taking showers on slippery marble floors. I've learned a lot from New Guineans, and the way that I brought up my sons, who are now in their 20s, was influenced by how my New Guinea friends bring up their own children.
Well, I have an American daughter, but I did grow up in Australia in the bush, and you do grow up with a little bit of a sense of nature and how dangerous nature can be with snakes and spiders and things that'll kill you and sharks, whatever. Nothing on the level of how forbidding the environment and terrain is in New Guinea, where it's even more hostile. And to some extent, I see my daughter living in the computer age, staring at her palm while three or four of us, her friends, sit at a table staring at their palms. You do get you've brought out in your new book, Jared Diamond, The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. You brought out the concept of constructive paranoia. So it seems to me that that's a real insight, and elaborate on it, if you will.
That's an insight that I gained from New Guineans. The eye-opening moment for me was when I asked some New Guineans to make a campsite for me under a huge tree. It was gorgeous, and the New Guineans said, no, this tree is dead. And I looked up and I said, yeah, it's dead, but it's not going to tough and robust, it's not going to fall down for 40 years. But the New Guineans refused, and I eventually realized if you're going to spend your life in the jungle, and if you camp out, if you have the habit of camping out under trees, for which dead trees, for which the chance is 1 in 1,000 they'll fall down that particular night, you probably not die that night, but if you're going to spend more than 1,000 nights in the jungle, eventually you will die. Applications to my own life where I'm ultra careful, some of my friends would say careful to the point of paranoia, about recurrent risks that are low each time. Prime example is taking a shower. So I take a shower every day, and I took a shower 5 hours ago, and it was, I'm sure, the most dangerous thing that I'll do today. Reason is that my shower, like most showers, is marble. It's hard. People slip in the shower. All you have to do is read the obituary columns in any newspaper any day, and you'll see that a significant number of older people die as a result of falls or get crippled from falls from slipping. So I'm very careful about showers. I'm very careful about driving. I've learned from New Guineans to be constructively paranoid. That's to say, to be ultra careful about things that each time they've got a low risk, but you're going to repeat them thousands of times.
Again, I'm speaking with Jared Diamond, professor of geography at UCLA and the author of the bestsellers Collapse and Guns, Germs and Steel, which won the Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. So compared to constructive paranoia, we have a kind of artificial paranoia. I mean, if you watch the evening news or local news in particular, you'd think the world has gone mad. Do we pay a collective price for how much we are overstimulated by the threat of terrorism, and even the weather forecasts are apocalyptic nowadays, even though, of course, to some extent, global warming is creating apocalyptic weather. So what price do we pay? Again, the point in many ways of your book is that we have hunter-gatherer bodies that are living in this environment where they're not being used, in effect, in the way that they're intended.
Yeah, the price that we pay for our obsession with terrorists is that we use up our concern about danger on the wrong things. There's only so much of your day that you can spend worrying about dangers. You'd better devote those hours worrying about danger to the right dangers. And if we obsess about terrorists, and we obsess about nuclear radiation, and we obsess about DNA and chemicals in our crops, we're focusing on the wrong things, the things that we should really be concerned about that will kill far more of us than will terrorists, are driving in cars, alcohol, slipping in showers, and falling off stepladders, and depending on your lifestyle, various other things. So part of it is a matter of figuring out the right danger. The other thing you mentioned about our hunter-gatherer bodies is that our bodies have not changed that much since we stopped being hunter-gatherers, which variously is from a few decades to a few thousand years ago. And our bodies are adapted metabolically to having lots of food sometimes and no food other times. That's all very well until you are living in Los Angeles on a supermarket diet, eating three big meals a day. And if you continue to eat the way a hunter-gatherer does and to store food as fat, you are likely to end up with diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and cancer, conditions that no New Guinean ever dies of.
But in your book, Jared Diamond, your new book, The World Until Yesterday, you cite the example of the island of Nauru, which is independent now. It was a former German, then Australian colony, where rich in phosphates, and that the people did experience there. They were hunter-gatherers. Food supply was never guaranteed, and periodic famine. But the minute they started to get royalties from phosphates, then they went to the supermarket, they got fat, and I think, was it up to 70% of the population has diabetes?
By age 70, yes, those few narrow ones who are lucky enough to survive till age 70, something like 70% of them get diabetes. Nauru is one of the three populations in the world with the highest frequency of diabetes. But this isn't just, we used to think, oh, those narrow ones are so exceptional. We now know that all populations around the world, other than Europeans, to whom this happened centuries ago, all other populations of the world, when they start adopting the supermarket Western lifestyle, end up with high frequencies of diabetes. This is attested within North America, especially for Native Americans and for African Americans, as well as Europeans. It's attested for Aboriginal Australians, Pacific Islanders, and nowadays, within the past decade, the two countries that have the largest number of diabetics in the world, although a few decades ago they had vanishingly few diabetics, are India and China, because with rising affluence, wealthier people in India and China are eating a lot and they're getting diabetes.
Well, I spoke recently with a researcher up at UCSF who's doing research into childhood obesity, and there seems to be an undeniable connection between particularly high fructose corn syrup, which is in almost every food that you buy, every item that you buy in the supermarket has it in it. And so you don't make the case, but can one make the case that corporate food is killing us?
One can make the case that some corporate food is contributing to killing many of us. It means that we have to be attentive in what we eat and read the labels in the supermarket. But on top of that, it's not enough for us as individuals to be attentive. For example, my wife and I, we don't have salt on the dining table. And I used to think that I'm virtuous, I don't take in much salt, therefore I'll have low blood pressure. The sad part of it is that a lot of the salt and a lot of the sugar in our diet is hidden. It's cryptic. It's been added by the food manufacturers so that when you buy any food or when you eat in a restaurant, even if you don't sprinkle salt on your food, you're taking in a lot of salt. Adding salt to food is something that food manufacturers do because it's a cheap way of binding water, and therefore, instead of you are paying for 1 pound of chicken, you're paying for 1.25 pounds of chicken, even though only 1/4 of it is chicken, and only 1 pound of it is chicken, and 1/4 of it is salt water that's been injected. All of this is a way of saying that not only do we have to be attentive to our personal choices, but we've got to get our government to work together with food manufacturers to impose healthy standards on food for the public.
And Jared Diamond, another aspect of a modern life in the sense that what we're losing in terms of the what we call primitive societies or traditional societies, the notion of the tactile nature of child rearing, which is in traditional societies like in New Guinea, for example, women carry the babies with them everywhere. And I'm fascinated to see how you've pointed out here how much we lose in terms of nurturing children by having kids in a pram that we push where they're facing in the wrong direction. And so just elaborate on that point, because I find it fascinating.
I, too, am fascinated by it. Part of my fascination comes just over the past 50 years with dealing with young New Guineans, kids who are 5 years old or 7 years old, and they're self-confident, and they'll talk with me as an adult, and there's no shyness about it. They make their own decisions. In one case, about 45 years ago, I was hiring carriers in a village, and I needed lots of carriers. There was one kid, he was probably about 10 years old, who volunteered to be a carrier for me. So his parents weren't around, but he didn't ask his parents' permission. It was taken for granted. He's a 10-year-old kid. Of course, he can decide what he wants. And so he marched off with me to carry for a week. And then at the end of a week, I wanted to hire some people to work on birds with me. So he stayed another 3 weeks. His parents didn't know where he was, but he's a 10-year-old kid, and he's capable of making his own decisions. We don't allow that. We micromanage our kids. We don't allow that freedom. We don't hold our kids. We put our kids down in a crib so that they're not in contact with an adult as infants, whereas a New Guinean or a traditional child is in contact with an adult like 95% of the time.
So just in closing, Jared Diamond, it seems that given what you're telling us in this new book, The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies, that we can't go back. We can't, perhaps we should change our society radically in ways that in which we'll be healthier and more in touch with our environment. But it does seem that we've just gone through Christmas, and you've got this very, very telling picture of how in traditional societies, children are given toys which are manufactured out of what they can find, and they still find them inspiring and entertaining. And then you've got it contrasting that with a young American girl surrounded by a surplus of toys, which now, you know, a week after Christmas, I'm sure a lot of stuff has already been shoved in the closet. So we have this culture that tells us that we need things and that we're insufficient as human beings without things. And that seems to be the big challenge, isn't it? As we're all downsized out of economic necessity. And another point you make it too is that as a society, we should learn from other societies that revere their elders. And as you know, this whole fiscal cliff argument's been over cutting Social Security benefits for the old. So we are going in the opposite direction in terms of reverence for the elderly. And I don't see any evidence that we're starting to come up with different ways for our children to find self-esteem through other things other than material possessions.
Well, you put your finger on a dilemma. As you said at the beginning, there's no going back. And yes, there's no going back massively. We're not going to have radical change in our society. If you suggest any radical change, people will close their ears. But we can make selective change, and there is going back in certain respects. For example, spanking or not spanking your children. When I was growing up, it was usual for parents to spank their children. But there are lots of parents today who don't spank their children, and in small traditional societies, parents don't spank their children. That contributes to the children being self-confident and independent and making their own decisions. As for revering elders, a real challenge for the United States and for all Western societies is to find a use for older people. We are getting technologically outdated. I can't turn on the wretched computer that my wife and my sons have, but I can operate a slide rule, but who on earth wants to use a slide rule nowadays? So on the one hand, much of my knowledge is out of date and I lack modern knowledge that's important, but on the other hand, I've experienced things that happened 40 or 60 years ago that young people 15 or 20 years ago haven't experienced. And so, for example, when I talk to hedge fund managers, the people managing hedge funds typically are in their 20s and 30s. They haven't been through a Great Depression. They haven't seen the big swings of 20 years ago, and that's part of the reason why the average hedge fund lasts 5 years, because the young whiz kids just don't have the experience of older people.
But just to the point of how do we, as a society, if we are to, in effect, be downsized as more people on the planet, as the haves and the have-nots meet somewhere, I think inevitably we're going to be downsized. The planet cannot sustain everybody having the standard of living of the average American and consuming as much as the average American. So it would seem to me that inevitably we'll have to find another way to find work for people and to judge people based upon other things than the number of their possessions.
You're correct that we have to lower our consumption rate. That's the biggest part of it. Another part of it is reducing or at least not increasing further our population, but lowering our consumption rate is a big piece of it. I get hope there because I came back recently from Europe, and Europeans per person consume not much more than half of the average American, and yet the standard of living in Europe by any reasonable criterion, such as educational opportunities, security in old age, standard of living in Europe is, if anything, higher than in the United States, despite their consuming less. So I take hope from that. There are people out there who enjoy a first world living standard, but they don't consume.
Well, Jared Diamond, obviously we could talk on forever here, and I'm very grateful for the time you've been able to spend with us.
You are welcome. Thank you for your interesting questions.
Again, I've been speaking with Jared Diamond, who's a professor of geography at UCLA and the recipient of many awards, including the National Medal of Science, the Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement, Japan's Cosmos Prize, a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, and the Lewis Thomas Prize, honoring the scientist as poet. His books include Why Is Sex Fun?, The Third Chimpanzee, Collapse, and Guns, Germs, and Steel, which won the Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies?
And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing.
Bye for now.